Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, May 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, bringing new technology to the Saratoga community by providing telehealth care for routine and urgent care. Telehealth medicine at Saratoga Hospital, saratogahospital.org, to learn more. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology. She is here to discuss cancer treatments that can't wait during COVID-19, as well as the steps being taken to protect cancer patients currently in treatment. It should be a popular program. I advise you to call early, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist and your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology is here to answer your questions about cancer treatments today. While treating all types of cancer, Dr. Evangelist specializes in lung cancer and sarcoma. She also serves as the principal investigator for all lung cancer clinical research trials at NYOH and is a member of the International Association for the Study of Lung Cancer. Dr. Evangelist received her undergraduate degree at Skidmore College. She then attended Albany Medical College, where she received both a Master of Science and a medical degree and completed her residency. Dr. Evangelist's fellowship training in hematology and oncology was at the University of Tennessee in Memphis. Dr. Evangelist serves as an assistant clinical professor at Albany Medical College and currently sees patients at NYOH's Albany Medical Center and Clifton Park locations. If you want to be a part of our conversation today, give us a shout. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, 1-800-348-2551, or you may email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me.
You know, we see news of, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but stroke patients and heart patients are going to the doctors less during this pandemic. Perhaps very, very important medical issues. And people are saying, you know, I'm going to stay home. How has this pandemic and the resulting lockdown affected what you do in treating cancer patients?
Well, you know, we are seeing a lot of disruptions in care due to COVID-19, and certainly cancer patients are amongst the most vulnerable. And so we've implemented a lot of changes to make sure the patients can get the care that they need. You know, cancer doesn't stop with COVID-19, so we want to make sure that they have access to the care and it doesn't get disrupted.
What kind of changes have been made and are being implemented now as far as protection of those who are really vulnerable?
Well, I'm lucky enough to have an organization that has a task force looking into COVID and how it's impacting our patients. And they've been really working tirelessly. They meet every day, and they've really had to be pretty agile at, you know, working with the CDC and New York State Department of Health recommendations. So we've implemented a lot of things, and I'm happy to say we've implemented them pretty early on. We've had to adopt an early triage system so that we can identify patients early that might be at risk of having COVID so that they can get the care for the COVID, but also to prevent infection of both patients in our office and staff. And we've had strict stay-at-home if you're sick policies with our employees. And then we've had to make some pretty tough changes, I think, for patients, their families, and frankly, for the providers. We've had to really decrease the traffic in our offices. So we do have staff who don't need to be directly a patient facing at home, so they're working remotely, which has been a challenge for all of us in COVID. And then we've been rescheduling well visits or moving them to telehealth. So that's been something that's new, seeing patients via a video platform. And then the probably most difficult change is that we've had to limit visitors into our offices, again, trying to decrease the traffic. So that means that patients are coming in without their family members for their treatments and their visits. But we've been making a lot of effort. This is not how we'd like to operate, but it is so critical at this time to protect our patients. So we have been, you know, using telephones and FaceTime to try to make sure that everybody's connected.
Go ahead. No, you finish.
Oh, no, just lots of things that we're doing. So, and then everybody's masked. So all of our staff is wearing N95s, and then we're asking patients to come in masked. And if they don't have a mask, we provide them with one.
You know, telehealth is something that those of us who've, you know, have routine visits often say, well, gosh, we could probably do this over the computer. As I understood it, HIPAA regulations and other things prevented that to some extent. Now that that door is open, Dr. Evangelist, do you think that door will stay open? Is telehealth here to stay?
You know, I think, I hope it is. You know, it's not something, it's technology, and sometimes that can be challenging for all of us, both patients and providers. Things don't always go the way we want it, but I have to say that it's been a lot more pleasant of an experience than I had anticipated. I'm used to sitting in a room with a patient and their family members, being close to them. I think that's really critical. I had my first visit, and the thing that was very striking after weeks of wearing an N95 is to get to see my patient and to get to see their family members and to get to see their face, and they can see my face. So there's a lot that it's offered us, and I think that under the right circumstances, it actually could enhance the patient experience, allow us to connect with our patients you know, more frequently, and also take away some of the burden that comes with having to travel in and out of the office.
We're joined today by Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology. She is here to answer your questions about cancer treatments. The number is 800-348-2551. You mentioned that the volume of patients actually in your physical waiting room is down. And given the seriousness of many types of cancer and many cancer cases, does it disturb you at all that you can't see patients as quickly as you would like?
Well, I think that what we're trying to do is a number of things. One is to ensure the safety of our patients. We know that COVID is serious for anybody, but our patients are the most vulnerable. We know that if they contract COVID, that they're more likely to have complications. And so we have to do everything in our power to make sure that they are as safe as possible. And implementing some of these measures also is important so that we don't let COVID be a barrier to them getting the care that they need for their cancer, because the cancer is equally serious.
Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist is our guest. It's Medical Monday, 800-348-2551. If you have a question about cancer or cancer treatments, now's the time to call, 800-348-2551. Dr. Evangelist, we'll take a break and be right back and hit the phones. Vox Pop, Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're joined by Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology today, who is here to answer your questions about cancer and cancer treatments. And we start out with David in Saugerties. David, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Evangelist. Thank you very much for coming on the show today. Shortly before the the whole outbreak and lockdown of COVID-19, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and it was highly recommended that I consider surgery or radiation treatments. But in doing my due diligence, I have come across some other possibilities, and one of them is called HIFU, high-intensity focused ultrasound. And I was wondering if you had an opinion on its efficacy on prostate cancer. My Gleason was a 3-4, a 7, 3 plus 4, grade level 2, and it had 29 Oncotype DX.
Yeah, so I'll start by saying I'm not a prostate cancer specialist, and I don't have a lot of familiarity with that form of treatment. What I can say is that, it's a personal decision. You know, I think that you have to make with your cancer team about when is the right time to get the treatment. There are some cancers that you can postpone the treatment, but many you cannot. And so talking to your provider about when the delay can occur, or maybe resequencing some of the treatments that might be available. But I wish I could give you more answers, but that's just not my area of expertise.
David, thank you very much for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology is here, and she specializes in lung cancer and sarcoma. Also serves as the principal investigator for all lung cancer clinical research trials at NYOH. Tell me about the most exciting to you research trial that you have seen in the last year or two.
Well, I can tell you about a trial that we got some preliminary data that came out just last month. What we've seen over the last decade is that we're understanding cancer better, we're understanding lung cancer better, and we know it's not just one disease, but it's many. And a lot of the things that are driving that understanding is the genetic makeup of these tumors. And so we've seen development of very effective treatments, particularly for patients with what we call driver mutations. And to date, they've been primarily used for patients with advanced cancer. And we've been anxiously awaiting them to be used earlier to try to improve the chance for cure. And so a trial looking at a medication called osimertinib for a specific subtype of lung cancer, we got the release that it looks like it's a positive trial in improving outcomes following surgery. So I'm anxious to see that publication when it comes out. We're pretty excited about that.
But that's only the first step, right? You get a positive result, and then it goes to another phase, right?
Well, right. So when clinical trials are done, they're typically studied in patients with advanced disease after we've exhausted available treatments and we're trying to determine if they're better than best supportive care. Once we know that a treatment is effective and safe, then we start to compare it to standard of care treatments. It's only over time that we move it into that curative intent setting where we want to see if that improves cure. So the good news is that this drug has been out and has been available and has made a huge difference for patients with an EGFR mutated lung cancer. But what we're excited about is to see that more people with this type of lung cancer can benefit from it and benefit earlier on. And again, cure is what we're going for.
Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology joins us on this Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. And let's go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim.
Which types of cancer are most sensitive to infectious disease?
Can you expand on that a little bit? What do you mean by susceptible to infectious disease?
Well, sarcoma or carcinoma.
Do you mean which patients are more at risk for developing an infection because of their cancer?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, any cancer that might interrupt the normal function of an organ, I'll give you an example of lung cancer since that is one of my specialties, is if patients have a disruption in the airflow in and out of the lungs, that may put them at a predisposition for getting infections in the lungs. Similarly, if a patient has a, say, a tumor in the belly that obstructs the flow of urine, they could be at more risk for infections that way. But I think maybe what you're also getting at is how does some of our cancer treatments pose susceptibility to infection. We know chemotherapy can suppress the immune system, and that can put our patients in a vulnerable scenario for getting infections. Because the immune system is not as strong. And then some of the supportive medications like long-term steroids that patients may need to be on can impair immune response and may put patients at risk for more serious infections.
Jim, thank you very much for the call. Our number here on this Medical Monday is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology. Patricia in the Hudson Valley. Patricia, you're on.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Doctor, I hope you can help me. In September, October, November, December, January, February, March, April, I was in the hospital anywhere from 3 to 13 plus days. I was recently diagnosed with JAK2, and I have to get blood transfusions, and at time I get an iron transfusion, and the last three times in the infusion center, they gave me darbepoetin.
Darbepoetin.
What can you tell me about JAK2? Because, see, they didn't know why my hemoglobin was dropping so low, and now my doctor is trying to keep my platelets up and give me a hemoglobin. Plus, I also have a heart condition. I have mitral valve prolapse, AFib, and tachycardia, and I already had congestive heart failure, and last Easter I had a stroke. Not a stroke, but a heart attack. But what can you tell me about this JAK2?
Sure. Well, I'm sorry to hear that you're going through all of that. What I can tell you is that JAK2 is a mutation that we can see in certain types of cancer, including hematologic disorders or blood disorders that affect our bone marrow. The bone marrow is where we make all of our normal cells, like our white blood cells, our red blood cells, and our platelets. The platelets are the cells that prevent you from bleeding, and it sounds like those are low, as you're saying. And then the red blood cells are the ones that carry oxygen and kind of give us energy, and patients can become anemic when those are low. And so when you have a disorder with a JAK2 mutation in the bone marrow, that can sometimes crowd out the area where you would make your normal cells, and you can see those decreases in your blood counts. And so there are some treatments that are focused on JAK2. Without the specifics, it's a little difficult to say which would be the most appropriate, but I think talking to your doctor about when do we do those treatments, does that make sense for me, they may be able to give you some more insight.
Is JAK2 a cancer? Is it a blood cancer, actually?
We call it a myeloproliferative disorder, so it's similar to a cancer in that the cells are abnormal, and it depends on the scenario.
Okay. Patricia, thanks a lot for the call. I would just remind our listeners, when you're going on the air, if you could turn your radio down, that way we're not hearing back the last question. While we're answering this question, it would be very helpful. The number here is 800-348-2551. We are joined today by Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology, and you are involved in clinical research trials. And I guess, from what I understand, you were named to a national group that works to get more people enrolled in research trials. Why are they so necessary?
Well, I think clinical trials are so necessary is because, you know, we don't want to be status quo with the treatments that we have. You know, we've had chemotherapy for a long time, and we know that while that can be helpful in certain circumstances, it also comes at a cost of toxicity. And we know that we do a better job treating cancer if we understand what's causing the cancer. And so a lot of these trials are looking at newer, more effective treatments that also are often less toxic than our conventional treatments. And that's so important because it makes a huge difference on how patients do, not only long term, but how they function day to day and their quality of life. So we're always trying to push the dial forward, get a better understanding of cancer so that we can treat patients better and they can do better.
Give me an example of a treatment for, say, lung cancer that is less toxic than the traditional chemo or radiation or whatever it is that is the state of the art.
Sure. There's actually two categories of treatment that are new and have made a significant impact. Back to the targeted therapy. The targeted therapy is targeted in that it focuses on the abnormality that's leading to the cancer while, in effect, sparing other cells. Not that they don't come with side effects, but patients can have really significant improvement in their quality of life because the treatments are effective in minimize cancer-related symptoms without adding the burden of toxicity. So that's been really remarkable for patients. And then the second category is immune therapy. And immune therapy is a way of treating cancer that helps enhance a patient's own immune system to fight the cancer. And while there are clear potential toxicities associated with it, when they compared it to chemotherapy, they showed that patients had improved quality of life scores and fewer severe side effects. So both of those have been really remarkable.
We'll get back to the phone calls in a moment here, but if you could just explain to me what immune therapy is and why it has toxic ramifications.
Sure. So there are actually a number of different immune therapies, but I think most people talk about immune checkpoint inhibitors. So your own immune system identifies abnormal cells like bacteria, say the strep bacteria, and mounts an immune response with antibodies to eradicate the bacteria. When it's done, it has a feedback mechanism that tells it to shut off. Well, cancer cells are pretty smart, and they can help sort of shut off the immune system and ineffectively prevent it from identifying a cancer cell as being abnormal. So these medications help take that check off and allow the immune system to activate and fight the cancer just like it would bacteria, if you will. Now, the immune system is pretty complicated, so that's a pretty simplified explanation. What happens when we see toxicity from these treatments is that in some cases, the immune system can become overactivated. And so, in effect, you see not only an immune response to the cancer, but an inappropriate immune response against a patient's normal cells. And so we call those immune-mediated toxicities or side effects. And they're treated very differently than the side effects that you would see from a chemotherapy.
Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology is our guest. You want to finish that point, and then we'll jump back on the phones.
Sure. So I just that the treatment is often using an immune suppressant for a temporary period of time to sort of quiet the immune system so that it can continue to treat the cancer without having the collateral damage from immune-mediated toxicity.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 on this Medical Monday. Let's go to Charlie in Albany. Charlie, you're on.
Hi there. Dr. Evangelist, I just have a question for you regarding the consumption of marijuana. I've read in the past that some studies have shown that marijuana smoking is less likely to lead to lung cancer than smoking cigarettes. Is there any truth to that? And, you know, what do you need to know as somebody who may be dabbling in that area?
So I think the jury is out really about whether or not that's safer or less safe. As a lung cancer specialist, I don't like anybody inhaling anything into their lungs. We don't know how just simple daily exposures and work-related exposures might have an impact. I think what I've seen is I have seen young people with chronic changes that I would expect to see in somebody who has smoked for many years. And that's because we are seeing people who are not just dabbling in marijuana, but are smoking it on a daily basis. And that can be just as harmful as smoking cigarettes. The other concern that we see is inhalation of other products like e-cigarettes and vaping products that may seem more natural than tobacco, but actually may be damaging lungs as well. So I would advise against inhaling marijuana, but I can't say it's safer or less safe than tobacco.
All right, Charlie, thank you very much for the call. We're joined today by Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a quick break and then hit the phones once again for the home stretch on this Medical Monday. Vox Pop, Medical Monday, Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We talk cancer, specifically lung cancer and cancer treatments today with Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology. And Helene is in Plainfield, Massachusetts. You're on.
Hi. Hope everybody's well. I first got diagnosed with non-small cell adenocarcinoma in 2015. I had two tumors. They did two wedge biopsies. I had follow-up CAT scans, and 2 years later, I got again diagnosed in just one of my lobes. So they removed my upper lobe, and I had chemo. I'm on six-month CAT scans, but my last pulmonology visit was my breathing is absolutely normal, and I'm wondering whether I'm more at risk for COVID-19. Because I'm missing a lobe.
So what we know is that patients, even patients who are in remission and doing well, can be more susceptible to having complications from COVID because of your prior surgery, like you're saying. And we don't think that you're still immune compromised from chemotherapy because that would be about 3 years out. But, you know, not knowing your medical, other medical conditions, that's certainly a possibility. So that's one of the reasons that we're urging everybody to take extra precaution, even if you haven't had cancer-related treatments or don't have active cancer, to take those extra precautions and socially distance and make sure that you're connecting with your healthcare providers if you have any new symptoms.
Well, I have a CAT scan in a week, and then I see my oncologist in 2 weeks. So my next question is, I do have some spots on my left lung that they're following, and he said something to the effect of if they grow in, I will have to have radiation, but if they grow out, I can possibly have surgery, and I'm not clear on how that works.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. In that terminology,
they're very near the edge. They're very near the outside of the lung.
Okay, so what they may mean is that if, depending on the location in the lung, they may be amenable to doing another wedge resection or surgery to remove it. Otherwise, we are using a pinpoint radiation called stereotactic body radiotherapy for patients who might have a tumor that is not in an ideal a site for surgery, or the surgery might leave patients with increased shortness of breath due to too much lung being removed. So that may be what they're talking about. there's, you know, this is one of the difficulties when we're doing these scans is that a lot of us do have nodules in our lungs. And when you have cancer, you know, obviously it can bring worry, but many of these can still be benign. But obviously we need to monitor them and watch them and see how they behave over time.
Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Joanne is in Selkirk. Joanne, you're on.
Hi. My husband is a cancer survivor. He had stage 3 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it was about 9 years ago now. He had 6 months of chemotherapy. I'm living in Selkirk. He lives in New York City, near New York City. We've been apart since this started, the COVID issues, and I want to see him again. And I work as a essential worker, you know, in retail and a grocery store. He's laid off, and, you know, it's been a long time, and I just don't want to put him at risk. Mm. He's healthy otherwise, and at least seems to be healthy now. And I'm healthy. I've been tested and I'm negative. I don't know about the immunity or the antibody test, but I'm going to my doctor on Wednesday to see if I can learn more about that and if I'm eligible to get one. And I'm just wondering, you know, 9 years ago when he seemed healthy, I'm a fearful, very careful person, and I don't want to put him at risk.
Well, I think this is one of the things you're really highlighting what has been such a challenge for our patients and family members and even as providers, you know, the last thing that we want to do is to contract COVID and give it to people who are vulnerable. You know, I'm hopeful that because he's 9 years out that his immune system has recovered from the treatments that he's had. But, you know, we're telling everybody to socially distance and to take those precautions. So that means family members, grandparents, everybody separated physically so that we don't put people at undue risk. And that's so difficult. But I would have to continue with the recommendations that everybody else is giving is to stay distanced if you think that there's a potential for contracting it and giving it to him. And I'm so sorry. That's so difficult.
Yeah, and it's been hard.
Yeah.
Joanne, thanks a lot for the call. We are joined today by Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology. You just mentioned you had hoped that the previous caller's husband's immune system had bounced back to normal or improved in the 9 years since treatment. Is there an accurate and sort of reliable way to measure one's immune system?
Yes, so you can do blood work and look at the recovery of the immune system. So that's something that we do when we're monitoring people who are on treatment. And
how do you do that? Check.
It's a simple blood test, a CBC, and it looks at your total white blood cell count, and then it looks at a breakdown of all of your blood cells, including your white blood cells, and those are the ones that fight infection.
Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number, and looks like Andrew and Troy is next. Andrew.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is for the doctor, and I appreciate all the work that you're doing in your elective field. What do you think about the tobacco company's contributions thus far to research and development of successful treatments and helping to eradicate the complications caused from smoking? And what is your opinion as far as this being the cost being rolled back down to the consumer, like it is in such states as New York that actually raised the prices on tobacco for the consumer? Do you think that has caused a decline in tobacco use, or did it stay up, or did it just stay the same?
Hmm.
Well, I can't speak towards the tobacco companies' research and how it pertains to cancer treatments. I think there has been a decline in the use of tobacco, but unfortunately, we're seeing an increase in the use of other smoking-related tobacco-less substances like the e-cigarettes, like vaping. We're seeing another wave of young people inhaling substances into their lungs that are addictive and that could be causing unclear damage. So we hope that we can learn our lessons with what has happened with tobacco. I don't think I'm answering your question, but I don't know if I have a direct answer for it.
All right, Andrew, thank you very much. Yeah, that's a little out of your field, but an interesting question all the same. The number here is 800-348-2551, as we are joined today by Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist of New York Oncology Hematology. This email came in from Aaron, and then we'll go back to the phones. Aaron writes, "From time to time, I experience periods of difficulty achieving a full deep breath even while resting. This seems to be accompanied by an elevated heart rate. I'm 40 years old, non-smoker, 10 to 20 pounds overweight, had been previously diagnosed with mild sleep apnea over 5 years ago, but do not seem to exhibit symptoms, do not use a CPAP. Do you have any ideas what could be going on?" And that's from Aaron.
Sure. So one thing that happens to a lot of us and is probably happening a lot more lately is that we're sitting more, we're in front of desks, we're not moving as much, and so you may see from time to time that we're just not expanding our lungs as fully, and our diaphragm is the muscle that helps open up our chest and bring air into our lungs, and so it may be that you need to stand up and do some deep breathing exercises, and that may help. The other thing, if you are carrying extra weight, some weight loss may help. You know, extra weight around our mid drift may potentially decrease the movement of the diaphragm and just may make it more work.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday today. Let's go to Dennis in Clifton Park. Dennis, you're on.
Yeah, Ray and Doctor, thank you for taking the call. Doctor, my question is this. I'm 67 years old, and I have just anxiety like everybody else about lung cancer because I know it's a leading cause of death. And I'd like to know, is there any diagnostic procedure, if I was willing to spend extra money, that you'd recommend that I could go do just to confirm I don't have any concerns with my lungs?
So right now, there's not any clear test to know that other than doing imaging like a CAT scan. So for screening of lung cancer, we use a low-dose CAT scan, but that really has only been shown to be a benefit for patients who are at highest risk, so patients who've had a long, extensive period of smoking. I don't know if you have any risk factors like tobacco use, but the good news is that a lot of research is underway right now looking at improved techniques to identify cancer earlier. So researchers are looking at doing simple blood tests that might be able to identify circulating cancer cells or circulating DNA from cancer cells that might identify a cancer early. They're also, at least in the world of lung cancer, looking at analyzing the air that we exhale for certain substances that might give us a clue that something is happening and identify a lung cancer early. But I think, you know, there's risks to doing CT scans without clear symptoms or without a clear risk profile. You know, when you do CAT scans, you can find things like we talked with an earlier caller about pulmonary nodules or nodules in the lungs. Many of those end up being benign, and patients are put under unnecessary procedures that come with risks that you may not want to be doing that kind of testing.
Okay, well then, thank you very much, Doctor.
Yep.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. What have we learned in the last 20 years in treating lung cancer? What advances would you say are the most important ones we've made?
So the I'll go back to the most remarkable ones are identifying that it's not just one disease. Lung cancer is really a number of diseases, and they all deserve a unique and effective treatment. And so the biggest thing has probably been the identification of these driver mutations, so that we know that a certain lung cancer may be responsive to one treatment and not another, and we're pairing the right treatment with the right patient. I think the other major advancement has been the identification of the role of the immune system in cancer detection and treatment, so with immune therapy. I think that what's on the horizon is what I was just talking about with the last caller, is this new technology at looking at blood tests to help really drive decision making. So one of the things that we have seen in some other cancers is that we can do tests and it'll help determine whether or not a patient needs chemotherapy, or maybe that's unnecessary and that's not going to offer any benefit to them. Then we can forego it and forego the associated toxicity. So again, making sure we're giving the right treatments to the right patient and not giving unnecessary treatments to people who don't need it. So people are looking at that circulating tumor cells after somebody has, say, a surgery for a lung cancer, and helping determine what their risk is of a recurrence and whether or not they need additional treatment, or maybe they don't. And that would be really helpful, because I get that question a lot from my patients, and I have it myself, is, okay, the surgeon got it all. You know, why do I need this chemotherapy, and is it going to benefit me? And how do we know it works? Well, the cancer's already been taken out, so I don't know if it works. I don't have anything to measure. So we need a test that's going to be able to help us answer that. So that's on the horizon. We're pretty excited about that.
Has the severity, how do I say this? Chemotherapy can be a brutal thing. Has the dosage levels or the chemicals themselves used, have they changed and become less severe in their side effects?
Well, I think two things have happened with chemo. One is that they have developed some newer chemotherapies, but chemotherapy in general, when we talk about it, it really just helps attack cells while they're reproducing. So it can affect any cells that are doing that. We haven't had a lot of new innovative chemotherapies. It's really different classifications of drugs that are more targeted. But we have seen some newer chemotherapies that are better tolerated. But unfortunately, for many patients with cancer, they still need some of those old reliable chemotherapies that can be toxic. But one good thing that has happened is that supportive care has become better and smarter. So we've gotten a lot better, for instance, anti-nausea medicines and supportive medications to help, one, prevent side effects from the chemotherapy, and to address them as they come up. I think the other thing we're seeing in cancer care is the importance of a palliative team. At NYOH, we do have a palliative care team, and they're really critical to help patients when they're going through these treatments, as another layer of support to help manage side effects that come with these treatments. So we found that people do better if they have a palliative care team as part of their treatment, and we're making sure that we're getting that incorporated into a patient's care as well. So if they need those old, reliable chemotherapies, that they can get it, but they can hopefully have less toxicity with them.
Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist joins us today. And only a few minutes left here, but let's go back to the phones. Jane in Albany. Jane, you're on. Oh, Jane, can you turn your radio down just a little bit? Hi, Jane.
Yeah, I just shut it off.
Okay, go ahead.
This is quite a while ago, okay? I either read or heard that a person is most likely to develop cancer after a year to a year and a half after a significant loss in their life. And I'm wondering if the doctor heard of that, and if she did she find that to be so among her patients?
That's interesting. I have not heard that. I don't have a just thinking, I don't have a clear rationale of why that would happen. I mean, the body-mind is important. It certainly can affect how a patient, say, who has cancer does. So we know that things like depression and anxiety, and actually this has been studied in lung cancer, that patients do better if they have this identified and treated. They actually can have improved outcomes compared to patients who have things like depression and anxiety that are not managed. But in terms of being a root cause for cancer development, I'm not familiar with that.
Well, you know, thank you, Jane, for the call. We only have a minute or so, minute and a half here. Why is it, and we hear this all the time from medical professionals, I have no reason to disbelieve it, that a positive outlook plays an important role. Why would that possibly be?
Well, I think we talk about it as having your head in the game in my practice. You know, I think that, one, there is probably a physiologic basis. Neurotransmitters, they certainly line our GI tract and affect our bowels and function. So there is something physiologic, but also patients who are depressed or anxious, they may not be sleeping as well, they may not be eating as well, they may be withdrawing, and it may impair or be a barrier for them getting the care that they need in a timely manner. So I think there's a lot of layers to that, why they may not do as well. And that's why it's so important we acknowledge it, recognize it, and address it.
Well, Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist, we are done for today. I hope things get easier for you, and I hope things get easier for everybody here in the course of this lockdown. Things look like they may be improving here in the upstate New York region anyway. So, Dr. Mackenzie Evangelist, thank you for being with us today, and we hope to talk to you again soon. Support comes from Hudson Valley Cancer Genetics, providing cancer risk assessment, genetic testing, and consultations for patients, survivors, and their family members, serving the entire Hudson Valley, HudsonValleyCancerGenetics.com. Well, thanks once again for joining us today on the program. Thank you for calling. Thank you for listening. Thank you for writing. Thanks to the, it says here, the wonderful Charlene Knight took your calls. Did you write this, Charlene? No. Thanks to engineer Zach Malloy. That's all it says, Zach. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, BST Financial Advising joins us to answer your questions about COVID-19 loans and what to do with your money during this pandemic. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.